the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, the federal government is widening its right to repair reforms to cover agricultural machinery. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, made the announcement on Friday, and the latest bushfire outlook has been released, and it's reports on which parts of the country could be facing a high risk of fire this summer.
The areas of Australia that are probably more likely to have a high risk of bushfire, the southern parts and southwestern parts of Victoria, after really long drought conditions in those areas over a number of years. Once the heat of summer gets in, they're expecting the fuels to dry out quite quickly. There's a lot of grassland over the central west, northwest of New South Wales that is quite dry, and there's been some active fires there over the last couple of days.
We'll hear more on that bushfire risk shortly. We'll also be hearing about working dogs as well, because the trial's been on over the weekend at Blaney. But also there was an auction and the top dog sold for $20,000. We'll find out more about that shortly as well. But first up today, the latest seasonal outlook is predicting that it'll be hotter than average temperatures across most of the country over the summer months. And initially they were saying it would be wetter, but they're now moving back from that and saying it's less likely to be wetter because of a change in some of the main features. I spoke just a short time ago to Felicity Gamble, who is in fact the lead or the one of the top analysts in regards to long-term forecasts, about what they're expecting and what actually changed in the recent outlook from the BOM for the next month or so.
Yeah, that's right. So our model is showing increased chances of a warmer and drier summer for much of the country, really. Much of that dry signal is actually focused in December. So once we look towards January and February, we are seeing that dry signal ease back just a little bit. And there's a couple of things that are contributing to that. So it may seem a little bit counterintuitive given that we have just announced La Nina being underway in the tropical Pacific, where we might expect things to be potentially wetter than average with that, and also that negative IOD that we've been seeing over in the Indian Ocean. Now, that negative IOD is rapidly coming to an end, so I think we're likely to see that finish up in the next few weeks, and so that takes out that wet influence. And the La Nina is a very weak, it's really only just meeting La Nina thresholds at the moment, and we don't really anticipate intensifying too much further. It's quite late in the year to be developing, and we're not expecting it to last much into the new year either. So a very weak and short-lived event. It's not having too much influence from the looks on our long-range forecast. This time of year, we typically see La Nina influence shift further north as well. So we might see a little bit of a wet influence over the far northern Queensland areas, but really we're not seeing too much of an influence coming from the Pacific.
So initially, though, we were expecting it to be a bit wetter, but that's now changed, has it?
That's right. So at this stage, what we're seeing happening is sort of potentially wet signal that we might see from a La Nina, particularly if it was a bit stronger, is being counteracted by what looks to be another developing phase of, or a negative phase of the southern annular mode. We would normally in a La Nina see a positive phase, so it is a little bit unusual to be seeing this negative phase of the southern annular mode. So that potential wet influence also has moved out of our region. So we're left with just, you know, this negative phase of the sandwich does appear to be influencing some dry conditions, at least into December.
And there's been some talk about, and it's been very dry in the Riverina and Western Riverina, Western New South Wales as well, I gather. Is that likely to continue? It's going to be hot and dry, particularly in the west of New South Wales, you think?
Yeah, that's what our forecast is indicating at the moment. So we are seeing...
And elsewhere in New South Wales too, do you think?
Yeah, it's mainly at the moment we're seeing the strongest signal in central parts of New South Wales, but it could extend across much of the state. And just given that that sudden shift towards drier conditions that we've seen across New South Wales and parts of Queensland since around the end of September or October, we have seen soils and much of the vegetation start to dry off during that those last few weeks or months of dry conditions after what was a fairly wet start to the year, especially across the eastern seaboard, where we saw quite a wet winter in many areas. So, yeah, certainly playing into the bushfire risk for the summer in parts of New South Wales and also parts of eastern Victoria as well, where we did see those wet conditions, quite a lot of fuel growth, and now we are seeing a shift towards what's been a bit dry in recent months and likely to continue into December.
And how hot is hot? We talk about global warming. Are we likely to see like record-breaking temperatures?
Very difficult to say at the moment in terms of those records. We're certainly seeing very strong chances of exceeding median summer temperatures basically across the country. We do also provide forecasts for the chance of temperatures being unusually warm. And when we say unusually warm, that's referring to temperatures in the top 20% of the historical range. So we're also seeing increased chances of seeing unusually warm temperatures across much of the country, particularly in the southeast, so including Tasmania, southern parts of Victoria, and parts of the north and west. And in particular, overnight temperatures as well, we're seeing very high chances of being in that unusually warm category. So certainly pointing towards seeing an increased risk of extreme heat, so, you know, heat waves across much of the country. For the north, that real danger period is in that lead up to the onset of the monsoon. So you get very oppressively warm temperatures until we do see that shift into monsoon, when we get that relief across the north with those westerly winds that come in and bring some of that that drenching rain and cool off the temperatures. Further south, though, yeah, we do start to see those particularly warm temperatures as the summer moves on. And, yeah, it's very hard to say whether or not we're likely to see record-breaking temperatures. No doubt there will be some heat records, seen. We see them pretty regularly these days. But how summer will rank at this stage, it's very difficult to say.
That's Felicity Gamble, who's at the Bureau of Meteorology, and she's an expert in the long-range forecasting. You might have some thoughts on that. Looks like it'll be hotter and drier than they expected for the summer outlook. You can always send us a text, 0467 922 684. Hard to know if it'll be record-breaking, but certainly they're saying hotter and drier now, which is quite a bit of a change from what they were saying just a month or so ago. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. Well, still looking at outlooks, and the latest bushfire outlook's been released. It reports on which parts of the country could be facing a higher risk of fire this summer. The message to Australians, as always, is to prepare and plan for dangerous bushfires, even in places where the risk levels are normal. And with a hotter than average summer forecast, as we just heard there, fire authorities are warning of highly flammable conditions in a number of regions. The outlook is released by the National Council for Fire and Emergency Services. And here is the Chief Executive, Rob Webb, with a bit more.
The first message is that all Australians will be preparing right now for the summer conditions, so anywhere can have a bushfire. The areas of Australia that are probably more likely or have a higher risk of bushfire are the southern parts and southwestern parts of Victoria, after really long drought conditions in those areas over a number of years. Once the heat of summer gets in, they're expecting the fuels to dry out quite quickly. It's a bit of a green tinge around Victoria at the moment, but fire authorities there are expecting things to dry rapidly. There's a lot of grassland over the central west, northwest of New South Wales that is quite dry. And there's been some active fires there over the last couple of days. And then further west into Western Australia, different parts of Western Australia down in the southwestern parts with a higher than normal fire risk. But as I say, with bushfires, every year is a year that Australians prepare. But those areas that I've just talked about are particular attention, pay particular attention and make sure you get your preparations in place.
So particularly high-risk areas you just outlined there. How do you assess those risks?
Look, the experts from across fire agencies, from the fire agencies across Australia, sit down with the climatologists from the Bureau of Meteorology and look at the fuel state, so the grasslands and the forests, how dry they are, how much the fuel there is, and the Bureau provides useful input into the climate conditions coming. And then, and from there, they start to assess based on real conditions on the ground. The fire services come together, and we develop the outlook from that. So it's really a meeting of the best minds in the country coming together and assessing fire potential.
Certainly the Bureau's told us we're in for what could be a hotter than average summer, but we've been told, are in for a La Nina, which normally brings rain. How does that marry up?
Yeah, that's right. I think for a very bad bushfires, there's a few elements that you need. The short-term climate conditions are one part of it, but then you also have these longer-term deep drying. So even average rainfall now across many parts of southern Australia, even average rainfall would not cancel out that deeper drying. So once you get, a week or two of 35 or 40 degrees, you will quickly find that grasses start to dry out, become much more brittle, and bigger trees start to get into a little bit more stressed as well. So it's one of those things. I think remember just what it feels like, even in our backyards after 3 or 4 days of high 30s, and imagine that across a landscape, a forested area or something. And once you get strong hot winds coming through, that's certainly
recipe for disaster.
Something to be watching.
Yeah, absolutely. How does this summer compare with the couple of previous summers we've had in terms of the forecast?
Yeah, so the typically across the southeast, there's been Victoria's been fairly similar with big, large areas dealing with the longer term drying, and Western Australia likely is the same as well. Earlier on, so 2 or 3 years ago, we were on the back end of the really heavy rainfalls that led to lots and lots of grass growth, and that was certainly of concern through Queensland and New South Wales. But what we're finding now, that long-term drying until we get really good, consistent rain across the south of the country, is something for us to watch, whether it's this fire season or the next, that we're through. Out many of the major fire disasters in our history, there's been that one of the elements you see, one of the tripod would be this deep drying. So it's an area that all fire services are watching closely over the course of the summer.
So it really is, alarm bells should be going off as we go into this summer, is what you're saying there. It's a slightly worse outlook than we've had in previous years.
In parts of Australia, yeah, but it's the same preparations. We're just people sitting around at the kitchen table and understanding what you'll do. Are you going to leave early? If you're not prepared to stay, then the best thing to do is just leave early. But make sure everyone in your family know what they're going to do as well. Make sure the property's prepared. What are you going to do with your animals? Where are you going to go if you do leave early? They're all really important things that are much better to have that conversation without fire in the landscape than waiting for the day.
Talking about the situation with the bushfire outlook, that was Rod Webb, who's the Chief Executive of the National Council for Fire and Emergency Services. He was speaking there with Sarah Morris. It's 18 minutes past 12.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
European breeds thrown in the mix, some Simmental and the odd Black Angus.
The Country Hour.
It's a bit of a fruit salad.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
Food of the gods.
On ABC Radio.
People texting in saying the bomb models are labelled as more like guesswork than science, saying they've been dead wrong since April. Dave in Trundle says it can't get any drier out in Trundle. The tinder dry paddocks with small dams near empty or dried up. And he's sent in a photo as well to show just how dry it is. And it looks pretty dry, according to that photo that Dave has sent in. Also, someone's texted in. Chris has texted in from Forbes saying it seems the bomb is looking in the rearview mirror rather than looking forward with their forecast at Forbes. We've had one of the driest springs on record rather than well above average rainfall that was forecast, says Chris. And Dave, also in Trundle, given us a bit more information, saying only 16 millimetres of rain for November for Trundle. And that was on top of what was a very dry winter as well, I seem to remember. It's coming up to 20 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, the Blaney Working Dog Challenge happened over the weekend, which consisted of both dog trials and an auction, where the top dog sold for $20,000. Capri Misty is a 3-year-old fawn and tan female Australian Kelpie. Following as the second top price was Jed, a 20-month-old male black and tan Kelpie who sold for $15,000. And the third, Stanford Quads, a 6-year-old black and tan male Kelpie sold for $11,000. Decent sort of money, isn't it? The results from the trial, they'll be out tomorrow, but the showground was full to the brim of dogs showing off some of the best work in the yards. Our rural reporter Emily Middleton caught up with one of the organisers, Megan Rutherford, during the event.
The idea behind it is we're just trying to showcase what working dogs can do for the industry and how useful they are for people to get their jobs done in everyday life on the farm. And so running a sheep trial and a cattle trial, and the cattle trial is more practical based than the standard cattle trial. It's a little bit different. So it's sort of based on real work and a bit more practical than the standard open cattle trial. So if you want to put young dogs in, or for people who are less experienced, it's really good because you're allowed to help your dog out and walk around the arena a bit, whereas usually you're not. And the yard trial, we're starting out with the maiden, which is the youngest dogs and the most inexperienced. And then the novice, which is a little bit more experienced, we will have an open, which will have a truck component and a bigger arena. And those are for the dogs that have the most experience and have been successful in trialing in the past and have gained, you know, their position there.
How did this working dog trial come about? Has this been happening for years, or is it a new thing?
So B&L originally started, Boa and Livermore originally started this trial a few years ago at CTLX out at the sale yards, along with the sale yards, and they began the trial and have had the auction as well, and then they have are still involved, but we've come on board to help out with the trial component and because we do a little bit of trialing and to add, you know, a bit of knowledge and just a few more helping hands, I guess. It started there and here we are now at the Blaney Showgrounds.
What's the best part of running these trials here in Blaney?
I guess it's pretty cool to bring such a big event to Blaney and into the community and to be able to say, like, that we're pulling it off successfully. And a lot of people run trials all over the state and country, and it's pretty cool to be one of those people.
How did you get into dog trials?
Originally, when we first moved down here, my husband busted his knee at uni and decided that maybe playing footy wasn't a good idea and started dog trialing, and I went to a few and thought, this seems pretty fun, and so then we both got into it.
What goes into training a working dog to the 12-month stage, at least?
My 12-month dog, she is doing some jobs. Like, she's been out on the farm doing real jobs in the shearing shed and in the paddock, just on sheep. And there is a bit of training involved, just so you can get a bit of a handle on them. They're just like kids, you know, they don't know what you want of them, so you got to show them and put a command to it as well. So she's doing small jobs out in the paddock, and from here on in can only move forward and get more and more handy as they develop in their brain and in their work.
Has there been a particular dog in your lifetime that's really stood out to you as a really good working dog?
So, yes. So I do have personally, for my own dogs, I do have one dog in my life now. He's getting on a bit. He's 9 now. I don't want him to grow old, but his name is Mars, and he has been a pretty handy dog for me, doing everything. He works sheep and cattle and does everything I ever want of him. If you ask anyone, they would probably tell you that he's definitely my favourite dog. And I've definitely seen some very handy dogs in my time of other people's. And because we have a Kelpie stud as well, we're trying to breed something consistent and something that works sheep and cattle and that's practical in our everyday life.
Absolutely. There's always going to be a favourite. There's always going to be one.
There is always one. So he's my favourite in my working life so far.
Favourite dog there. Favourite child even. It's... That's opening up a can of worms, isn't it? That's Emily Middleton talking there to Megan Rutherford, one of the organisers of the Blaney Working Dog Challenge. On the bomb, and someone's texted in to give the bomb a bit of support, saying the bomb is on a hiding to nothing, aren't they? If people want to complain, they just turn it off or ignore the forecast, make up your own forecast and see if that's better. There's a lot of heroes out there blaming the bomb for their own decisions. Maybe those heroes need to go to an industry with no climate risk. This person is texting in to say. You can always text into the country. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. Well, rising tide protesters took to the waters at Newcastle Harbour over the weekend with the aim of stopping coal ships entering the port. The Port Authority suspended shipping two coal ships and two cruise ships. Rising Tide community organiser Zach Schofield claimed the protest was successful and says impacting non-coal ships was not the group's intention.
There is no argument that can be possibly made to suggest that we would ever block a cruise ship. Hmm. I mean, this is the conversation that I had with the Viking customer affairs executive yesterday in Sydney. She was extraordinarily sympathetic to this position because no one can look me in the eye and suggest that Rising Tide would ever have an interest in blocking a cruise ship. Now, she escalated my petition, I suppose, to Viking to reconsider their decision, for the benefit of the hunter, to their US office. And the US office came back saying that they had been given advice that there was a security risk.
And 141 people associated with the event have been arrested. Two women were arrested aboard a ship off the Newcastle coastline. Marine Area Command, the Rescue and Bomb Disposal Unit and Polar Air responded to the incident. Inquiries about the incident are ongoing. Police also attempted to stop a boat after it allegedly entered an exclusion zone. The boat allegedly failed to stop as directed and police pursued it on a jet ski and say there was a collision. Before they arrested the woman, she was granted strict conditional bail. Also, in terms of other news, the Port of Newcastle confirmed that the Ragnar coal ship was turned back on Sunday afternoon. The 85,000-ton bulk carrier Semtex Leader was turned back on Saturday morning after being advised by police there were swimmers in the shipping channel, and the port said the ship was able to enter on Sunday morning. Paul Turton spoke to the Chief Executive Officer of the Port of Newcastle, Craig Carmody, about the impact of this protest.
Four vessels were prevented from entering the port, two of them being our diversified trade. One in particular was for Tomago, so we all know the stress that Tomago is under at the moment. It wasn't really impactful to our operations, but that's not the issue, is it? It's just unsafe. That's what we've always been worried about. We'll manage it, but we do not need people getting harmed or, worse in our channel.
Does Newcastle get a bloody nose out of this, do you reckon?
It certainly doesn't help us. The challenge we've got is 98% of everything we do goes overseas, mostly to Asia. And, you've got Japan particularly, who are highly reliant on us. We've got, a lot of our grain at the moment is going to places like Indonesia and Turkey. And they sit there and go, mate, you're telling us you're a reliable port. You ask us for this new business. We give it to you. And then we see this sort of nonsense, like, how reliable are you really?
It's legitimate, though, isn't it, for people to voice their concerns, given, of course, the climate crisis that we're confronting. If they have concerns over fossil fuels, they're entitled to voice their opinion, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, this is the conflict that we now find ourselves in as the port. When I started in this job, I'm now ticking up 7 years, for goodness sake. When I started, I said, people have a right to protest. And so we used to sit down with the protesters back then and we would do a deal. You know, it'd all be quite respectful. Every couple of years, they'd come along. We would essentially allow them to protest on the Saturday. We'd sort of do maintenance. We'd get everything sorted. We'd let them get all their photographs, get their videos on the Saturday. They'd have to be finished on the Sunday and shipping would start again. It'd essentially be one day. But we respectfully allowed them to do their thing. But they also had to be safe, not damage any of our equipment, not put anybody at risk, particularly the police who had to bloody monitor the thing. And then last year, out of nowhere, it becomes, no, let's do a 10-day protest. Let's get thousands of people here. Let's damage equipment. Let's put people at risk. Let's throw ourselves in front of vessels. And as you can imagine, all I could do was go, that is not going to happen. We cannot agree to that. And now it's just become this belligerent thing of, oh, well, we'll just screw the port as much as we can.
Does it cost you money? I mean, who pays for the tugs that have to go out twice, and if the ships get turned around or they're delayed for an extra day off the coast? There's a cost involved in all of that, I'm sure.
There is. So it pretty much flows through to first to the cargo owner, to the shipping line. But as we know how the world works, all it does is it actually flows through to the consumer. So the consumer up in Asia or the consumer here in Australia, somebody pays, and it's usually on the, you know, it's at the checkout.
Is it expensive to keep a ship out there for an extra day?
Yeah, the demurrage for shipping lines is actually quite expensive. It's not the not just the fees that they have to pay. It's, you know, you think you're a shipping company. You've got, you know, 3-day run down Newcastle, 1 day or so, 2 days in the port, and then 3 days back, and all of a sudden your captain's telling you, actually, we've been sitting outside the port in Newcastle for 3 days. The knock-on effect through your supply chain, that means that the cargo up in Asia or coming out of Australia may have to stay longer. You're paying storage, then you're paying crew, you're paying stevedores. It just keeps racking up.
That's Craig Carmody from the Port of Newcastle, and thanks to ABC Newcastle for those interviews as well. 29 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Some texts coming through still about the bomb and the outlook. 0467 922 684. Shortly we'll look at the issue of right to repair, because the Treasurer has made an announcement about that on Friday. That's coming up. But before we do anything else, let's get some news headlines from Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. The Premier is leaving open the prospect of talks with Origin Energy to keep the biggest coal-fired power station operating for longer. This is after the energy market operator warned the grid is not ready for the closure of the station, raising the threat of widespread blackouts. The state government and Origin struck a deal last year to keep Eraring open for 2 more years. And Premier says he's happy for Origin to talk to the government about keeping it open for longer. 4 Sydney men have been charged with being part of an international child sex ring, which is being described as satanic. Police say they discovered a Sydney-based network after setting up a special strike force to investigate the online distribution of child sex abuse material. It's alleged a 26-year-old man played a leading role in the network, which police say was involved in sharing images. Other men arrested include a 46, a 42 and a 39-year-old man. Early childhood educators are going to receive the second part of a government-funded pay rise today, with a 5% boost on top of the 10% which they received last December. Poor pay was highlighted in an ACCC and Productivity Commission report, which found pay was a key problem when it came to retention in the sector. And all pubs and clubs in New South Wales will now be forced to shut their gaming machines before 4 a.m. and 10 a.m. next year. The government is hoping the reforms will end exemptions that dated back 20 years, which basically allowed venues to vary the hours that they did open. So you won't be able to have a pun on your way into work.
Mm. Oh, no. Like,
no.
What am I going to do?
Or
the hot toddy as well.
Yeah, exactly. all the things that get you started.
Before I head out to the railways.
Yeah, that's right.
Like the old days.
All righty.
Brings back a few memories,
yeah,
doesn't it?
It does, hey? Yeah.
One of my uncles used to go on about that all the time, actually.
Oh, I think I found myself in a couple of those places.
That's right.
From the night before. Not a...
early openers. Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, remember those ones.
Let's not talk too much about that.
I'm going back to uni now. Gee whiz. Yeah. All right, thanks for that, Adam.
All righty.
Make a walk down memory lane there.
Gotcha.
Adam Story will be back at 1 o'clock. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. Juan Park at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So we've got two different things happening in the state at the same time, really, in terms of the weather.
Yes, that's right. Yes. So in one hand, we are seeing cold and wintry conditions with winds and showers. In the south, while in other parts of the state, we expect extreme fire danger conditions today.
Extreme fire conditions for where? Give us the areas that's most relevant, I guess.
Yes, for Sydney and the Hunter and the Northwestern Fire District, well, we anticipate the fire dangers to reach extreme fire danger ratings today because of the windy and the dry weather conditions brought by a passage of a cold front expected today. And so with that, there is a fire weather warning as well as a total fire ban current for those areas. But in other parts of the state, we expect windy conditions with cool and gusty west to southwesterly winds with the average wind speed of 30 to 50 k per hour, possibly gusting up to 60 to 70. And not just that, but also we expect showers and gusty thunderstorms in those areas, particularly across the south, but with little rainfall, if at all. And there's some slight chance of small hail as well. And the wintry conditions brought by this system is also bringing snow on the alpine ranges. So, in summary, we have two extreme weathers. One in terms of the fire weather conditions in Sydney and Hunter and the Northwestern, while in the south we are seeing wintry conditions in December.
Yeah, quite a big drop in temperature there, but not much rain with the cold change.
That's right, yes. We generally expect only a few millimetres of rainfall in the form of showers or gusty thunderstorms. And also, as for the temperatures, yes, it will be cold, especially in the south, because it will be something like 6 to 12 or even 14 degrees below typical December average maximum temperatures, with the maximum temperatures expected to reach only mid to high teens on the southern and central ranges, and maybe low 20s elsewhere across the southern half, while in the north it will be slightly warmer with the maximum temperatures in, say, mid to high 20s. Then after the passage of this cold front, we also expect quite a cold and a dry air mass in the wake. So tomorrow will be a little bit cold, and we may possibly see frost in the morning across the southern and the central ranges, as we expect the temperatures in those areas to drop down to single-digit minimum temperatures, maybe around, say, close to zero, or maybe around 2 or 3 degrees in the morning.
Quite a big difference, isn't it, between, you know, two parts of the state there. They sort of, I'll draw a line down the middle and it's completely different.
That's right, yes.
You don't often see that.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I must say that it's quite unusual to see some snow in December, although it is only confined on the, far southern ranges and the alpine peaks.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Interesting to watch that. But then warming up as we get to later in the week. Is that right?
Yes. That's right. Starting from tomorrow, after this passage of this cold front, we expect the dominating influence of a high pressure system drifting across the state, and with that, we anticipate quite a dry and stable weather patterns from Tuesday through the midweek, and then later in the week, we may see a swing to warmer territory, with the temperatures rising back to, say, high 30s to low 40s in the west, on Friday and shifting to the eastern district and the northern areas by Saturday ahead of the next cold front. So maybe later in the week through the weekend, we may see heat wave conditions developing and also extreme fire dangers as well as potential, wind warning conditions may develop towards the weekend.
Yes, quite a big change there by the end of the week. Juan, thanks for that.
My pleasure.
It's coming up to 21 minutes to one on the country. We're getting some texts on the issue of the coal issue. Grant has texted in from Pitt Town to say happy 80th birthday for Wednesday for the country hour. But also Cole at Newcastle, he says, whilst folk should respect the laws regarding the ports, etc., he says he's got a question. If you take your rubbish to the tip, you've got to cover it. So how come if it's so vital, why can't the coal trains cover their loads as they go through schools and towns, says Grant. So he's making a point there about the coal industry. 20 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, the federal government is widening its right to repair reforms to cover agricultural machinery. Treasurer Jim Chalmers revealed the move after a meeting with state and territory treasurers on Friday. The legislation is expected to take shape from 2026. The group representing machinery manufacturers and dealers, the Tractor and Machinery Association of Australia, says it's not opposed to right to repair for the ag sector. But Executive Director Gary Northover told Brandon Long they were expecting changes to be announced, and they support the right for farmers to repair the equipment, but they don't want to see a free-for-all.
We're aligned in the fact that we do support a farmer's right to repair their own machinery. We do support the farmer's right to use third-party repairers to do those repairs. And indeed, many of our members have started to expand their offerings in this space with diagnostic equipment, parts manual support, generally to allow farmers to do that sort of work. So what we don't support is, as you say, the unfettered right to modify machines, and certainly that's not being proposed in this space, but we just want to make that distinction that this doesn't mean that there's a free-for-all in play in our mind.
Are there any points of contention, any things you disagree with some of the grower groups on?
Look, there's always nuances to that, but the principles contained in the Motor Vehicle Information Sharing Scheme consistent with our position. Clearly, there's work to be done on knocking out the detail of all that, how it will apply to agricultural machinery. So, we look forward to participating in that conversation. But as it stands, I think we're generally aligned.
Would there be concern from some of the member groups that they might lose out on some of the dollars?
I'd be naive of me to say that there wouldn't be some dealers that might be concerned about that in their own patches. However, many of our dealers report that some of their biggest customers are third-party repairers. So, I think by and large, we understand there just aren't enough technicians available in the industry within dealer networks to do all the work, and it's inevitable that, we need to support the role of third-party repairers and indeed farmers to do their own repair work. So, I don't think there's any sort of overarching level, any major concerns about that happening.
Executive Director of Tractory and Machinery Association of Australia, Gary Northover, speaking there to Brandon Long about right to repair, and Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer, has been contacted for comment. It's coming up to 17 minutes to one.
The Country Hour.
Celebrating 80 years.
Understanding how they grow best.
The Country Hour.
Nourishing the people in their own community.
Part of your community for 80 years.
It's highly regarded.
Weekdays at noon.
Go straight to the source.
On ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
More than 8 million brightly coloured sterile flies are being released on Kangaroo Island every week as part of an ambitious plan to eradicate the pest that can be a nightmare for sheep producers. Landlines Kerry State headed inside the secure facility where they're bred to see just what it takes to do battle with the blowfly.
Not far from Kingscote, I'm entering a curious facility made from shipping containers, which comes with an acquired scent.
So, Helen, what exactly is this place?
This is where we breed blowflies. So this is where we breed them and then we sterilise them and we release them to do their job.
And why are we gearing up like this?
We gear up here to stop any contaminants coming in with us, so we don't want other fly species in here, and we don't want to bring in parasitic wasps with us as well.
Once through the airlock, it's clear what they do want. Lots and lots of Lucilia caprina, better known as the Australian sheep blowfly. It causes 90% of fly strike, a painful and potentially fatal condition where flies lay eggs, usually on the back end of sheep. These hatch into maggots, which eat the animal's flesh.
So what room are we in here?
This is what we call the adult fly room. So this is where our breeders are that are busy growing and maturing and having sex and making lots of eggs for us.
Where do the breeders come from?
The original population actually came from fly strike samples that farmers on the island gave us.
Each breeding cage contains 30,000 flies living on a diet of sugar, water and yeast, the essentials for egg production. In another room, a different type of food is being whipped up for their offspring. Generously nicknamed porridge, but in reality a rendered down abattoir waste mixed with water.
This is specifically a meal that's come from pork, so right. Pigs. We actually tried other animals to see if the blowflies preferred, particularly sheep. We would have thought they'd prefer meat meal from sheep, but they don't.
From refining the feed to balancing the climate, producing enough flies to make a difference is challenging.
If you talk to anyone who breeds insects on any scale, they are fickle little sods. And every time we think we've got something sussed and we've got the right numbers of eggs and the conditions are perfect, then they'll just change their minds and it won't be the same the next time.
The team gets its first look at what's hatching when the egg collection trays are removed from the adult fly room.
So this is what you want?
This is what we want. Nice active mass like this tells us there's a lot of happy, healthy ones in there.
It's both kind of gross and yet my face is going closer.
Once the maggots are scooped onto their porky porridge, it's doors closed.
So I can only look through here at the moment. I can't go in, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Why is that?
At this stage of the larval development, they're actually farting a lot of ammonia gas.
Funny, but not.
Yeah, it's actually really toxic for us to be in there right now. Once we set up a room, we lock it out and it stays locked out for a whole week. And it's only when the maggots stop feeding and stop farting that it's actually safe enough for us to go in there.
After the maggots have transitioned into hard-shelled pupae, they're harvested. Then they're dyed a vibrant colour to distinguish them from the wild flies and sterilised using radiation. The aim is to outnumber the wild male flies 10 to 1.
So if the females, when they emerge from the ground looking around for a fella, they're more likely to come across one of our sterile boys because there's just so many in the landscape. We need these flies to definitely be sexy because the females of this species only mate once. And then if she mates with him, then she can't produce any eggs, she can't make a new generation, she can't cause fly strike.
So how do you make them more sexy?
We just keep them strong. We make sure that they're not just a weak little runty fly that doesn't go very far.
After a small field trial last year, the first large-scale aerial release is underway across Dudley Peninsula and a 10-kilometre wide strip up the middle of the island. While it's too early to say how successful it's been, wool grower Mitch Wilson was pretty impressed with what he was seeing when I visited his farm on the Dudley Peninsula.
This year we haven't seen any fly strike at all yet. Just talking to other people out of the area, they are getting some fly-blown sheep. So it looks to be very encouraging.
The state government and industry bodies have already invested $10 million in the project. Next year, the plan is to cover the whole island with sterile blowflies. That will require an overhaul of the breeding facility to produce between 40 and 50 million sterile flies a week.
If that all goes really well, the following year should predominantly be mop-up operations.
Do you think you actually can eradicate the blowfly on the island?
Absolutely. We've all got our fingers and toes crossed to make this work, but, you know, it's proof's in the pudding.
Absolutely. Proof's in the pudding. A great idea, though, getting rid of the blowfly. And you can find out more by checking out Landline, which is on ABC iView. You can check out that story on iView at any time. It's coming up to 10 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today as the energy grid is not ready for Eraring coal plant's closure. That's according to AEMO. And why the rise of rooftop solar has raised the threat of blackouts without supportive infrastructure. New debt-to-income limits on housing loans will kick in February next year. What does that mean for your house and the house you want next? And an ecological success story, moves to protect some species of fish along the Great Barrier Reef, has inadvertently helped to keep the crown of thorns starfish in check.
And here on The Country Hour, we're getting some texts on the Bureau of Meteorology. This one from Gwen saying, the bomb is not the problem. Climate change is the issue, says Gwen. Change being the operative word, changes in climate systems require changes in forecasts. And Gwen says, don't shoot the messenger. And in terms of bomb unreliability, that's proof that weather is becoming more unpredictable. This person has texted in to say, Lou's texting to say, also data from the USA is dependent on their bureau reliability, and they're under budget and services cuts over there at the moment. So not providing the data that they would normally be providing, perhaps, because of those budget cuts and issues in regards to their budget at the moment. It's coming up to 9 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country. Let's look at gold now. Australian gold production for the September quarter remains steady at 76 tonnes. That's worth a pretty penny at $15.5 billion. That's according to the latest figures from the mining consultancy firm Surbiton Associates. And Director Dr. Sandra Close says, given the current global situation, the gold price should remain supported for some time.
We found for the September quarter, Australia produced 76 tonnes of gold, and that was exactly the same amount as for the previous June quarter. So it's pretty stable at the moment, and that amount, 76 tonnes of gold, at the current price, and the prices are moving so quickly, it can be $100 in a day, but at the current price, you're looking at about $15.5 billion worth in Australian dollars just for the quarter's production.
Can you explain to us why they went up so sharply and then down again, Sandra?
I think it's people. In partly it's uncertainty, and I'll talk a little more about the uncertainty that we see all the time. But exchange rates vary. That can make quite a bit of difference alone. But it's also depending on what President Trump says or some other politician or a world leader comes out with, or what's going on, the latest stoush between them. And the market responds quite strongly now. Although, remember, with prices much higher, a variation of $100 is not as much as it was once. So it's all to do with playing with the numbers, I guess. You can never be sure. There can always be a surprise, like we've had in the past, whether it was the destruction of the trade center or Brexit or whatever. Anything can happen, but it's looking rather positive at the moment, I guess you'd have to say.
Sandra Close from Surbiton Associates. Let's go to markets now. First up to Bendigo Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers edged back to 21,100 lambs. The sale opened strongly but then lost momentum, and gaps developed later in the sale for trade and heavy lambs. It meant results went from similar to $5 to $15 a head off. There were still lambs which sold either side of $11 a kilo. But as the market faded, there was a lot of $10 to $10.80, some pens slipping under $10 a kilo. Heavy shorn lambs, $300 to $370, and the tops of the suckers, $300 to $380. Heavy trades, $260 to $280, followed by the general run of mixed trades, $220 to $260. Light lambs are a mixed bag. Some feature lines of little store lambs sold exceptionally well at $180 to $204. A lot of buyers then stepped into the bigger framed light trades at $190 to $230. The sheep market remained impressive, particularly for leaner and lighter mutton, which was dearer again to be tracking either side of 800 cents a kilo. Heavy sheep similar on less weight and quality this week. Heavy ewes $230 to $274 and merino wethers to $250. Decent light and trade sheep $160 to $230 for most. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Corowa Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon, agents penned a total of 6,550 lambs and 3,700 sheep with just over 5,000 new season lambs on offer. Quality was very mixed and competition was steadier from processors with the market slipping $10 to $20. Light and medium trade new season lambs up to $6 softer, $205 to $243. Heavy trade slipped $12 to $20, $234 to $270 to average 1,080 cents per kilo carcass weight. Heavy lambs slipped $18, $302 to $312. An extra heavy new season lamb export type sold up to $337. New season lambs, shorn, heavy trade slipped $8 to $20, $245 to $284. Restockers operated between 105 and 198 for lambs back to the paddock. Mutton trends were mixed. Extra heavy merino ewe slipped $7, $230 to $256. Extra heavy crossbreds gained up to $18, selling up to $310. I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA at Corowa.
Dubbo Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. Numbers are back by 2,000 for a yardie of 19,800 lambs. It was a mostly plain quality yardie with only odd pens of well-finished trade and heavyweight lambs mixed throughout. There were large numbers of secondary exotic lambs penned, showing the effects of the dry conditions, and hoggets were once again well supplied. Lightweight lambs to the processors were $10 cheaper, with the 12 to 18 kilogram two scores selling from $155 to $185. Trade lambs were up to 15 cheaper and more in places, with the 20 to 24 kilogram lambs selling from $235 to $294 to average between $1,090 and $1,170 cents a kilogram. The few heavyweight lambs were up to $30 cheaper, with the lambs over 24 kilograms selling from $286 to $334. Merino lambs were 10 cheaper, with the trade weights selling to $190. Lambs to the restockers and feeders were firm, with the restockers paying from $100 to $199, while the feeders paid to $180. Hoggets sold to $250. We have the balance of the lambs and 19,800 mutton still to be sold. This is David Monk in Dubbo for MLA.
To Wagga Cattle now.
Good afternoon. Cattle numbers continued to lift with 6,510 penned, and this included 1,370 cows. The quality was good and with plenty of young cattle that suited the feeder orders and just as many finished trade cattle. Grown cattle with condition and weight remain well supplied. The market is selling to a firm to slightly cheaper trend. Weaner steers to restock have reached 560 and the heifers 468. Light feeder steers went against the trend, selling from 450 to 542. Medium weight feeder steers eased 8 cents to average 474. The heavyweights have ranged between 450 and 522. Feeder heifers have lost 15 to 20 cents, medium and heavyweights, 380 to 460. Most of the trade cattle are ranging from 420 to 480, with a few pens of heavy steers selling to 511. The prime grown steers and bullocks, 420 to 490, while heifers, 442 to 474 for the heavyweights. Heavy cows were firm, 380 to 433. The lighter weights also firm, averaging 378, and more than half the sale is still to be sold.
Let's go to Forbes Cattle now.
Good afternoon. Numbers jumped this sale with agents yarding 3,414 head. Quality was fair with some good runs of well-bred cattle on offer, though there was still a percentage of secondary cattle available. The usual buyers are present competing in a market that sold firm to easier, with quality contributing to its strength. Yearling steers were firm to 8 cents easier, with those to feed selling from 440 to 534. Finish lines to processors received from 442 to 478 cents a kilo. The heifer portion corrected after last week's gains, with feeder heifers receiving from 415 to 468, while processors paid from 420 to 457. Heavy season bullocks were limited and reached 478. Grown heifers ranged in price from 393 to 450 cents. Cows held firm to 5 cents easier, with heavy finished cows from 383 to 420 cents, plainer types from 370 to 319. The best heavy wool reached 417 cents a kilo. This has been Crystal Ridley at Forbes from LA.
Tamworth Cattle.
Good afternoon. Numbers were back by 500 for a yarding of 3,700 cattle. It was a good quality yarding with some good quality prime cattle to suit the process, as well as good quality feeder and restocker cattle. The market sold to mixed trends and was generally cheaper on the lighter cattle to feeders and restockers, but trended dearer on the heavier feeders. There was solid competition and all the regular buyers were operating. Young cattle to the trade were firm, with prime veal and yearling steers selling from 465 to 484 and prime heifers dearer to 472. Feeder steers sold from 450 to 548 and feeder heifers to 466. Young cattle to the restockers and background are sold to mixed trends, with the young steers selling from 418 to 546 and young heifers cheaper to 450. Prime grown steers were dearer, selling to 472, and prime grown heifers cheaper, selling to 434. 2 and 3 score cows to processors are up to 30 cents cheaper, selling from 250 to 404, whilst prime heavyweight 4 score cows were 15 cents cheaper, selling to 417. Heavy bulls to processors were firm and sold to 398. Peter Dundon from LA, Tamworth.
It's 1 o'clock.